From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR's correspondents from around the globe. I'm Ted Clark. This week, China selects leaders for the next 10 years. Kenyans react to President Obama's re-election. And a stalemate in the battle for Syria's largest city. This week, China began a once-in-a-decade transition of power with the opening of the 18th Party Congress in Beijing. NPR's Louisa Lim is in Beijing and reports that this political transition is being carefully managed, and the winners are already known.
This is the Communist Party's party. It's a highly choreographed political ritual that plays out in the Great Hall of the People. The first step, a 1.5 hour long swan song by outgoing party leader Hu Jintao. Taking aim at corruption, he warned officials to rein in their families, a coded warning in the year marked by the scandalous downfall of a top official, Bo Xilai, for abuse of power and corruption. If we fail to handle this issue well, he said, it could prove fatal to the party and even cause the collapse of the party and the fall of the state. Outside the hall, the buzzword among the 2,000-plus delegates was hope. Hope for the future. We're going to build a cleaner government, says delegate Liu Lin, with cleaner officials, cleaner politics. This is in line with people's wishes. Center stage was China's former president, Jiang Zemin. He'd been rumored dead last year, but his comeback is personal and political, with reports he's stacking the new leadership team with his supporters. That could stymie reform attempts by the new leader, Xi Jinping, according to Kenneth Lieberthal from the Brookings Institution.
For these people coming in, there will be two generations of predecessors looking over their shoulders. Those generations will have cut the deals that will have put together the team that is now taking over. This team is not Xi Jinping's team. This team is Hu Jintao, Wang Jiabao, Jiang Zemin, etc.'s team. So that Xi has, first of all, a problem in getting everyone on the same page on the standing committee.
That team will be unveiled next week after the Congress closes. But it's clear the succession process is still hostage to patronage politics, and that could cloud the legacy of this leadership.
What strikes me is, in a sense, we have a situation where the Communist Party has returned to its historic template. It's a state within a state.
That's Kerry Brown from the University of Sydney.
You get almost tribal politics or tribal kind of networks where you just have sort of people around you look after, and almost like mafia politics. And that's, you know, a complete counter narrative to the one I'm sure that they would like.
This was Hu Jintao's day. His successor, Xi Jinping, didn't say a single word. That, too, is according to plan. But his low profile means few know what to expect. Here's Kenneth Lieberthal again.
For a person in Xi's position, it's frankly extremely hard to know how reformist he is, how determined he is, how tough he is. He has risen to the top in a very tough political system, so he's obviously no schmo. But for what he'll actually be like, he's gotten to the top because he's been very good at concealing that.
Change may be coming, but its limits were outlined today. As a parting shot, Hu Jintao made sure of that. Among the fuzzy pledges he made, there was one absolute. We will never copy a Western political system, he said. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
Kenya received the news of President Obama's re-election with jubilation. The East African nation is the homeland of Mr. Obama's father, and Kenyans were disappointed the president did not visit during his first 4 years in office. But as NPR's John Burnett reports from Nairobi, they have high hopes they will see their favorite son in his second term.
The elation was contagious on Wednesday morning when the news spread that the son of the late Barack Obama Sr., a Kenyan government economist, had held on to the most powerful presidency in the world.
How are you feeling this morning, this Obama Day morning? Talk to me and share your feelings with me, huh?
This Nairobi DJ could scarcely contain himself. Though the White House has made no promises, many Kenyans are convinced the president will finally pay a visit to the land of his paternal relatives in his second term.
Next year, he'll be right there with Air Force One.
In his first term, the president came no closer than Ghana and Egypt. The mood was ebullient at the big election watch party held at the U.S. ambassador's residence in a tropical suburb of Nairobi.
Yeah, very happy and proud of his success.
Jane Muridi is Dean of Studies at Mangu High School, which sent a group of maroon-sweatered students to the gathering to watch American democracy in action.
We feel great, and we have seen the way the Americans have voted. We are hoping the Kenyans are going to...
She was impressed by how quickly and peacefully the U.S. vote count happened, and she hoped that Kenya's own presidential election, set for March of next year, can emulate the smooth process. After the country's 2007 contested election, disgruntled Kenyans, divided by tribe, and brutally killed more than 1,000 of their fellow citizens. The eyes of the world will be on Kenya next spring to see if it can have a bloodless transition of power. Barack Obama is American, born in Hawaii, but here in Kenya, with its enduring traditions of tribe and clan, they resolutely claim him as one of their own. His father's family belongs to the Luo tribe, who hail from a western province bordering Lake Victoria. A 16-year-old junior at Mangu High School named Steve Njuguna says that President Obama is a role model for him and all of his friends.
Because they see it as an opportunity. If a Kenyan is able to go to the U.S. and become president, then they see it as something which is revolutionary, that Kenyans are able to conquer the world.
But you know President Obama is not a Kenyan.
Yeah, he's not a Kenyan, but he's Kenyan by nature.
Down at the newsroom of Nairobi's Daily Nation newspaper, columnist Jack Otieno says that Barack Obama has, in 4 years, become so respected that his popularity compares with that of former South African President Nelson Mandela.
Obama is a young Mandela. A lot of young people identify with this message of hope. It's restored the dignity of the black man, of the African, of the Kenyan.
In fact, says Otieno, President Obama is one of the only political figures that unites all of Kenya's fractious tribes.
You talk to a Kikuyu, talk to a Luo, talk to a Luya, talk to a Kamba. They'll tell you they love Obama.
John Burnett, NPR News, Nairobi.
Coming up, Syrian troops and rebels fight to a stalemate in the country's economic hub. Islamist extremists threaten the West African nation of Mali. And we take a ride on Africa's first high-speed train. This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Ted Clark. It's been more than 3 months since rebels in Syria launched an offensive to take the city of Aleppo. In the early days of that offensive, the rebels were able to take about half the city. But since then, neither they nor government forces have managed to gain the upper hand. And many have declared the battle for Aleppo and for Syria a stalemate. NPR's Kelly McEvers managed to get inside Aleppo late last month and sent this report.
Before the Syrian uprising, Aleppo was many things. Syria's largest city, the country's economic hub, Syria's cultural capital, one of the oldest continuously occupied cities in the world. Now Aleppo has earned a more ominous claim, a city that's seen some of the worst destruction since World War II. This used to be the place you'd come if you were a tourist in the Middle East, the tiny winding alleyways of Aleppo's old city, built around the 12th and 13th centuries. We went on a rainy day, which was good for one thing. The warplanes had stopped bombing.
We're standing under this beautiful old stone archway. It's pouring down rain. We're looking down this gorgeous little cobblestone alleyway where you see these wooden balconies sticking out of these little stone houses. If you didn't know it standing right here, you wouldn't know there was anything wrong.
Just a few steps down the alley, though, the spell is broken. We duck into a stunning old building with massive wooden doors covered in patterned copper.
What is this place?
It's a psychiatric hospital that was built in 1354. Now, rebels are using it as a base camp.
Some of them sleep here. Yeah, you can see their beds over there.
To say they've taken good care of the place would be a lie.
Shisha pipe, TV, generator, a couple of guns, a little oven.
Thing is, these fighters aren't from Aleppo. They come from the small towns and villages beyond the city. To make their mark, they've spray-painted the name of their village on the marble sign outside this historic site. Rebel fighters entered Aleppo's old city about a month ago in a push to take more territory. That push ended with parts of the historic old covered market, or souk, set on fire and destroyed, and few, if any, gains for the rebels. Now fighters just stand guard, trying to hold on to the parts of the souk they do control, while a new recruit from the village might find himself disappointed, says a rebel sympathizer named Maysoon.
And he's got his heart full and he wants to go and make clashings and, you know, fight, like real fight.
But instead, what he finds is a pretty boring guard post where he rarely sees the enemy. Once the rain lets up, we head out into the rest of the city. We start to hear telltale booms in the distance. Still, no warplanes. But it's the time of day when regime troops start shelling rebel-controlled areas. We drive to another frontline neighborhood, this one a more modern collection of concrete and rebar apartment blocks. You can tell when you're getting close.
The shops are closed. Lots of rubble in the streets.
The rubble is from the shelling and the warplanes. Entire floors are missing from the tops of buildings. Water mains and sewage lines are busted. The streets are covered in broken glass. The neighborhood is almost completely empty. We come up on a bombed-out apartment building that shelters the rebel unit stationed here. This is the front line.
So where are the regime troops and where are the rebels?
At that corner, hey. Across, that's the regime forces.
The regime's forces are only 50 feet away. The rebels are trying to gain ground away from this dense neighborhood and into an open area.
So they're trying to move in that direction. They're just trying to keep taking territory this way. The rebels are trying to go that way.
The regime is pounding the rebels with artillery shells that are exploding just down the block.
So they're just trying to move that way and take territory that way. To what end? What's the goal?
It's a question we put to Abu Ahmed, the commander of the unit that's holding this part of the front line. Up several flights of stairs in another abandoned apartment building, Abu Ahmed and his guys are squatting in a room with lace curtains. The power goes out halfway through our conversation. Everybody's smoking. Abu Ahmed says rebels took control of this area about 2 weeks into the Aleppo offensive, back in early August. Since then, he says, they've managed to gain about 6 blocks. That's just a few inches each day. Abu Ahmed says the ultimate goal is to take 2 buildings used by police and security forces.
Let's say they take these 2 posts, then what?
We'll take all the security bases, he says, then we'll free all of Aleppo, and we'll free all of Syria. It's as simple as that. Back outside, there's a lull in the shelling. A woman stands at an intersection with a look of horror on her face. A burnt-out bus blocks the view down the street to her right. A regime's sniper is posted on a rooftop down there. Rebels tell the woman to stay put, but we need to get back to our car. So we have to duck, use the bus as cover, and run.
Ready to go? Okay. They're warning the civilians, telling them, don't cross on this side.
She said she's going to bring her stuff from the house. So I told her to go bring her stuff and go from the back of the bus.
What is the regime's strategy? Why not use ground troops to retake these neighborhoods instead of random shelling and a few snipers? If the rebels lack a detailed plan, is the regime's strategy just as flawed? Military analysts say the Syrian army has the manpower and the firepower to retake Aleppo, but they say it's loath to put troops in harm's way for fear they would defect. What's more, they say the army might be saving its best troops and best weapons for more decisive battles, say if there's an international intervention in the coming months, or if the rebels acquire better weapons from abroad. So for now, it seems each side is hoping to wear the other one down. At this camp, about an hour's drive outside of Aleppo, rebel fighters who once served in the regime's army run training courses for civilians who want to join the rebel cause. The commander of the camp, Abu Mahmoud, says the rebels' offensive in Aleppo was a mistake. He says they should have taken the military bases outside Aleppo first. That way, less destruction would have been loosed on the people. Now that the rebels are entrenched in the city, he says, they can't retreat. With a sigh, Abu Mahmoud compares the Aleppo offensive to the entire Syrian uprising. We started it, he says. It's too late to turn back now. Kelly McEvers, NPR News.
There are fears that the West African country of Mali could become another terrorist safe haven, like Somalia or Yemen. Northern Mali has been overrun by radical Islamists after a coup toppled the country's government in March. The UN Security Council is now considering an international intervention led by West African forces. But as NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports, that could take a while.
A group of West African countries known as ECOWAS has until the end of this month to report back to the UN Security Council on their intervention plans for northern Mali. The U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, Johnny Carson, says the U.S. will help with logistics and intelligence sharing.
We're not on the front line, but the African states are on the front line, and our European partners are on the front line. But it is a concern. We fundamentally want to see the territorial integrity of Mali reestablished.
And no one wants to see al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb have a base to plan and plot attacks. On the diplomatic front, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton visited Mali's neighbor Algeria last week to get that country more engaged. That's key, says J. Peter Pham, the director of the Ansari Africa Center of the Atlantic Council.
The Islamist extremists in northern Mali would not pose the threat they do today were it not for the fact that they were able to run their supply chains back through Algeria. They would have no trucks, they would have no weapons, and they certainly would have no fuel. They'd have to walk everywhere all over northern Mali, which is an area the size of Texas.
And so Pham argues Algeria could squeeze the extremists by sealing off the long border with northern Mali. Algeria is also playing a negotiating role, trying to peel off the Tuareg separatists, called the Ansar Dine, who started the rebellion in northern Mali, from al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb and other foreign fighters who are also active in the region.
It's now not the flag of Tuareg separatism that flies in the three northern provincial capitals of Mali, but rather the black flag of al-Qaeda's regional affiliate.
Another expert on the region, Anwar Bukars of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, says it will take many months to prepare for a smart intervention in northern Mali. In the meantime, Bukars says diplomats need to figure out who's who.
They need to sort out who are the actors that are most amenable to a political solution. Probably Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, there is not much you can do with diplomatically. But Ansar Dine, the imminent power force in northern Mali, I mean, that's an actor that one can negotiate with. We know the Algerians are.
Just this week, Ansar Dine announced that it would renounce terrorism and allow in humanitarian aid. Assistant Secretary of State Carson saw that as a hopeful sign, pointing out that unlike other groups dominated by foreign fighters, Ansar Dine is run by a local Tuareg leader.
The Tuareg have longstanding political grievances. They have not been hardline Islamists. If we can pull them back, then that works in our favor.
But that won't alleviate the need for an international intervention, Carson says. The U.S. has already spent tens of millions of dollars in counterterrorism programs in the region, training and equipping African forces. Carson expects the U.S. will expand that effort as it continues planning for what he says will be an African-led intervention in Mali. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
Africa has its first high-speed rail service. It was built in the economic heart of South Africa to ease congestion. Passengers welcome its speed and reliability. NPR's Afebia Quist-Arkton hopped on board to try it out.
Welcome aboard Caltrain. Train 2, O.R. Tambo International Airport.
Here starts my ride on the whole train that covers both Johannesburg, which is the economic and business hub in South Africa, and Pretoria, which is the political capital. We're going down, right down, into the bowels of the Gautrain. What's exciting about it is it's the speediest train in Africa. It really is a first. And let's see how the ride will be and what other people think about the Gautrain. Here goes.
Attention, please. Passengers for O.R. Tambo International Airport, please change trains at Marlborough.
Visitors that are coming outside of South Africa, they are amazed because they do not expect to see a system that is on par with the best of the best in the world. Such a world-class project.
Kelebohile Machaba is a spokeswoman for the Bombela Concession Company, which operates the Gautrain. You have to put the Gautrain into context. South Africa's existing national metro rail system is like most rundown railways across Africa, dating back 50 plus years. They need a radical upgrade.
Train approaching. Stand back from the platform edge.
In rolls the Gautrain with its immaculate royal blue and gold livery. It came online just in time for another first for the continent, the 2010 Soccer World Cup Championship, hosted by South Africa. The network, with a stop at the airport, has since expanded, with more stations to come, says Machaba, the Bombela spokeswoman.
The Gautrain is primarily aimed at taking people that are using cars off the roads and into public transport to alleviate the congestion on the major roads.
Early in the project, there was criticism about the nearly $3 billion network and fears the Gautrain would simply serve a rich elite doing little for poor South Africans. Not everyone can afford, say, the $18 one-way ride to the airport from downtown Johannesburg, but a taxi costs easily twice that. Officials say the Gautrain is carrying up to 40,000 passengers on an average day. And that includes banker and regular Gautrain user Michelle Madden.
Love the train. It's convenient and it's very smooth. It's easy.
What did you do before?
Bus, taxis. And it was terrible and dirty. This is very clean.
Madden is taking the 30-minute trip from Johannesburg for a meeting in Pretoria.
I think it's wonderful because the buses are disgusting. The buses have chewing gum all over the floor and the seats, and they have chicken bones under the chairs, and it's disgusting.
Cheerful and polite, Chabalala Kasper is one of about 400 security personnel patrolling the trains and stations served by the Gautrain.
Yeah, clear. No one allowed to eat or drink here. Even chewing is not allowed. Even water, not allowed to drink.
You heard him. The Gautrain's rules are strict, but passengers say fare is fair because this keeps the trains spotless. First-time rider Rifilwe Edith Seyabi hops on in Pretoria. She's impressed.
Normally, the traffic, I know it, because sometimes Johannesburg from Pretoria, it would take me 2 hours because of the traffic. So I want to see today what time I'm going to board it and what time I'm going to arrive.
She's bringing along her sister, Girlie, for a spot of shopping in Johannesburg. But Seabi is a little nervous.
I'm very much excited and a bit anxious, and it's the first time.
So what are you expecting?
I'm expecting comfort, but I'm just anxious about its speed.
A speed of up to 100 miles an hour. But once she settles into the Gau train's upholstered seats, Rifilwe Seabi relaxes visibly and smiles.
The next station is Centurion.
Ofebia Kustalton, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Ted Clark.